iTropics leaving us alone, which is good. We'll take it for the next 7 days, right? That's all you can do at this time of year is go 7 days at a time. Otherwise, hot and humid with that chance for showers in August. Kind of, it starts earlier, I think, in August. 65% total chance for showers. But unlike June and July, it seems like we're into our typical August where it rains earlier, and then again, it'll rain after that. A new poll shows that young adults are less likely to say voting is important, is what I'm trying to say. Aaron Dusso joins us now, associate professor of political science at Indiana University, Indianapolis. How you doing, sir?
Good. Thanks for having me.
Tell me about this poll and what it shows.
Right, yeah. So AP NORC, they put out the poll that was asking people, and they broke it down by age group, how much interest they have in politics, how likely they are to participate in politics and that. And what they captured is actually consistent with what we capture whenever we do polls like this, going back many, many decades, is kind of the life cycle effect, is what we say, is that young people tend to always indicate that they're less interested in politics, certainly much less than individuals who are, say, over 50 or 60.
But they care about, I'm just going by my relationships or my interactions with people that are 28 and 30. First of all, what is the age group that they're defining here, Aaron?
They typically say less than, 30 or younger. So, and if you're talking voting age, 18 to 20, 29.
So what I found interacting with people of that age is that they're terribly concerned with the political climate, but I find a disconnect in that they don't want to get involved to do anything to change it. Is that accurate or not?
I mean, I see that too. I mean, I teach college classes, mm-hmm. and so I see that age group, the 18 to 22, all the time. And now I have a bias sample because they're taking political science classes, mm-hmm. and so I see a lot of interest in politics and quite regularly. But yeah, the question of do you go from interest to participation is a challenge. That's not just a challenge for the younger group, but it's actually a challenge for all of us. There's a great book called Politics is for Power by Eaton Hirsch, where he documents that people really see politics, no matter what the age group, as a political hobby, and that we follow it like it's a sport as opposed to something that we need to participate in.
That's what, in Louisiana, we say the two most entertaining sports are politics and football. That's the way
exactly.
And it's true. Politics is for power. I'm going to have to look that up and read that.
Yes.
Let's talk about historically in the country, how this whole at what point do people get involved politically? Because I don't know if you can generally say or not. I know there are some people that get elected to Congress when they're, 30? Other people, when they're 30, they don't even know who their representative is. So take me through that whole process historically in this country, if you would, Aaron.
Right, yeah, that's why we call it a life cycle effect, because what happens is young people from their teens up into their 20s, what happens is they have other things going on. They're trying to establish themselves as adults. They're finishing education. They're trying to find jobs. They're trying to find mates, life partners. They might, and so those things really distract them, a distraction in quotes, because those are important life events. But once they settle down, and they have a stable job, they can start to potentially buy a home or have a stable home. They're not moving around a lot. They marry or they find a life partner. They start having kids. That's when people start engaging in politics. That's when they start joining clubs. That's when they start showing up. That's when they start going to city council meetings, that kind of thing. So it takes time for people to establish themselves in life and also in politics.
Although they don't follow politics, they do follow political issues, right? On social media and so forth.
I mean, we could just talk about the campus protests that happened here not too recently, not too far ago, and those were all led by young people, right? So it was protests across that just started sprouting up on college campus, including our campus here in Indianapolis, and that was 100% young people. And so, they can care about certain issues a lot, and young people care about, say, the environment way more than older individuals do.
Does this have anything to do with, I hate to say work ethic because that's pejorative, but it's easy to show up and protest for a day, right, or 2 days, but to actively get involved in the system and start either working for a candidate or educating yourself on the issues or actively walking and knocking on doors and canvassing and so forth, that's a different animal. Accurate?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So, and that's even what that book I mentioned points out, is that there's easy ways for us to participate, which might be posting on social media or voting, and that voting is considered a fairly easy thing to do. We show up one time every 2 years, or sending a check. That not many people send checks to a campaign or that thing, but it's still easy. The hard part is I got to go to a meeting, right? I got to spend my time. I'm going to go knock on doors. I'm going to go sign people up to participate. I'm going to wear the shirt and I'm going to knock on doors. That's challenging. And most people don't do that.
I did that one time in my life for a friend who was running for something. I don't have to go into any more than that. But I'll never do it again. I never will. And it's not, look, I believe in this guy totally, 100%, but I just didn't feel comfortable. And there, look, you know, I always talk about, when you talk about political participation, yard signs, right? And yep. It's hard for me to find anybody that I would back with a yard sign, because what I'm saying at that point is, look, I'm giving him my, what's the word, imprimatur, right here. I'm saying he's my guy, or she's my girl, so if anything goes wrong, blame me. And I don't know that there's a lot of people that I believe in enough to do that. However, canvassing is an animal in and of itself. For people that don't know what that is, Aaron, explain, if you would, please. Have you ever canvassed, by the way?
Yeah, actually, and I did, of course, when I was younger. So back getting out of college, I was a campaign manager for a state house race in Michigan.
Really?
And so, yeah, I was participating in that. So I was knocking on doors every single day. And so it's so critically important, because what research actually in political science shows is that it actually has an effect, particularly with turnout. If you want to get your people to turn out, knock on their door and remind them that, and ask them to vote. I mean, people really appreciate just being asked to vote. So, yes. Getting people out and knocking on doors has a huge effect on politics. If you want to make a difference, that's probably the easiest and quickest way to do it, more than just posting on social media.
but it's hard work, and people, and not just hard work, but it can be uncomfortable sometimes where you go up to somebody's door and knock on the door and actually interact with them and explain to them why you're candidate. How would you canvass? What did that look like when you did it? I'm just curious.
So, yeah, so back in the 90s, we had a list of basically every single house in our district, from street to street, and we knew whether or not anyone had voted in a primary or had voted in previous elections. And so we would knock on their doors if they had ever voted before, and we didn't know exactly who voted. We just knew that that house had a voter in it, and you had your paperclip, you had your script, and you had some pamphlet to give them, so that they would have it. And most people are nice to you. I ran into a few people who was like, oh, boy, this is not great. Some people even are saying, yeah, give me a yard sign and we'll put it up in our yard. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it had a lot of great interactions. And, of course, the ones where you get a little heated, can scar you for life.
That jackass. That's, I'm sorry to bother you. Thank you. Have a good day, because apparently I'm not going to win you over. When you would encounter opposition, would you try to surface those objections and change your mind, or just walk away?
Well, some people were, would get emotional about it. So then you just kind of slow down and you're just like, okay, well, we can disagree. But a lot of times the people who had opposition actually just wanted to debate. Mm-hmm. And when I was 18, I loved debating. So I was happy to stand there and debate with anyone.
See, I'm going to pick your brain some more on this, having canvassed myself, because, and I'll ask the audience here at the Quinnard Jeweler Talk and Text Line, 504-260-1870. And somebody texted in about the young people in the political process. Is the apathy about they don't feel that they can change anything, even if they did get involved. And another question is, do they believe in either party enough? Because that's something that I think I want to address. I know I want to address it, but I think is important when we return, because are young adults disenfranchised with both Republicans and Democrats? And if so, what does that mean for the future? We're talking to Aaron Dusso, Associate Professor of Political Science at Indiana University, Indianapolis. The Quinnard Jeweler Talk and Text Line, 504-260-1870. Don't text and drive. But let me know, how have you reacted when somebody's knocked on your door canvassing for a candidate? Or it may have even been, I know in Belchase, we get the candidate themselves knocking on doors. 621 traffic now, WWL. 626, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to our friend Aaron Dusso, Associate Professor of Political Science at Indiana University, Indianapolis, about a new AP NORC poll that shows that younger people are not really that interested. They're less likely to say voting is important, I guess it'd be a more accurate way to put it. So when it comes to feeling as though nobody represents them, is that part of this where neither the Democrats or the Republicans represent them? Or tell me about that.
Right. I mean, this is what we call political efficacy. So that's it. internal political efficacy is a sense that I personally understand politics well enough to participate. And then there's external political efficacy, which is, even though I might feel like I know it, does anyone care? And it's certainly that the younger people feel that, you know, this low sense of external political efficacy, where they don't believe the system actually wants to hear from them or will respond to them when they actually say something or come out to try and, you know, influence politics.
So when you look at this study, does that give the advantage to one party or the other? Not necessarily.
Well, it gives an advantage to a party that depends on older individuals who tend to have stronger, you know, connections to the political system and are more likely to participate in it and more likely to turn out. So if you're, you know, you're a political party or you're campaigning and trying to gain older votes, you are going to have more success because they're much more likely to turn out.
So it seems like if younger people feel as though the system's not working, so I'm not going to vote, well, all that does is give power to the people that are making the system, in their opinion, not work. And the cycle, what is it, lather, rinse, repeat?
Right, yeah, self-reinforcing system here. But luckily, what, you know, data shows is that as they get older, they recognize the importance of participation. And so by the time they're in their 30s and 40s, they start participating. The exact same people start participating at a much higher rate.
So is it too late by then or not?
Well, no. I mean, unless
you change policies
to change
the government. That's what I'm saying. Policy is what I'm saying. Because here's a question. To me, here's the eternal question is, when people get to be 30 and 40, do they then realize what the people that were 30 and 40 when they were 20 realized? And then they're not as concerned with the greater good as they are their own or their own special interests. Or you understand what I'm saying, Aaron? Which goes before what?
Right, yeah. So it's a question of, do people, is there a life cycle effect in policy preferences, right? Does it change as you get older, or is it a cohort effect, meaning Gen X has certain policy preferences versus baby boomers versus Gen Z now? And actually what we see in data is that policy preferences for, say, a generation don't actually change. So every new generation tends to be more liberal than the previous one. And so you see this as they move through the system, you know, throughout their entire lives, their policies tend to stay pretty stable. You know, there's some variance, obviously, at the individual level, but overall, the cohort tends to be more liberal than the age cohort before
that. Then why are we as a country more conservative than we've ever been, it seems?
Well, how we define conservative, because if you think about, you know, 50 or 100 years ago, the policies are significantly different.
That's true. That's exactly right. It depends on how you define conservative. Thank you, Aaron. Very interesting conversation. Aaron Dusso, Associate Professor of Political Science at Indiana University, Indianapolis. We come back. We'll talk to Larry Carter, President of Louisiana Federation of Teachers. Schools started back for many. We'll talk about the challenges that teachers are facing and what their biggest concerns are and how many teachers actually have to go into their own pockets to help supplement what's going on in the classroom. And I know that happens on a regular basis, and the teachers aren't making that much to begin with. So then you're saying, all right, well, we're going to pay you X. Out of that, you're going to have to take some money to pay for supplies, which it seems as though the school should be providing, but it doesn't always happen that way. 6:30, time for WWL First News. For that, we go to Ian Ozan. 6:44, 16 till 7, Tommy Tucker, WWL. They have Alice Cooper's School's Out for Summer, but they don't really have a lot of songs about back to school. I guess maybe people don't celebrate that as much. Larry Carter joins us, President of Louisiana Federation of Teachers. How you doing, Larry?
Good morning, Tommy. How are you?
I'm good. I know y'all are excited because it's your chosen profession and you love to get back in the classroom, don't you?
Absolutely.
Larry, address this, if you will, please, because I talked about teachers going into their own pocket to pay for supplies, and inevitably, whenever I talk to you or about teachers, I get this text. And it says, well, teachers don't have it bad. I don't mean to put that voice on people, but I'm going to anyway. Teachers don't have it bad. They have the whole summer off. It's not about that. It's not. You would rather work 12 months a year and get paid more money, would you not?
Absolutely. And in fact, I often hear that, too, from those who are not, you know, in the classroom teaching.
Go ahead, finish.
30 or 35 students. So I do hear that as well.
And the other thing I'll say is that having teachers in the family, I can tell you, if you think their last day is the last day of school and their first day is the first day of school, you're kidding yourself, because that's not the way it works either.
Absolutely. Most teachers do have either second jobs or they also teach during summer schools to help students with enrichment during the summer. So it's not that every single teacher gets off during the summertime.
So I just throw that argument out. That doesn't matter at all, because it's not about that. It's about the chosen profession. What are the biggest challenges for the school year coming up that you're looking at as the president of the Louisiana Federation of Teachers?
Right now, in fact, I'll say this. As of today, our staff, the Louisiana Federation of Teachers staff, along with our affiliate staff and leaders, have probably attended about 40 events for new teacher orientations and back-to-school events. And what I've been hearing so far has been the same, teacher shortages and retention. Mm-hmm. We're still seeing too many educators leave the classroom. We've heard, I know through all the meetings I've been at already starting in July, teachers are retiring early. They're leaving for better paying jobs outside of education. And the truth is, when teachers leave, it's harder to find those qualified people to take their places, and that affects our students the most. And we still hear pay. Louisiana teachers and support staff, and you and I both know, work just as hard as anyone in the country, but we're still paid well below the Southern average. Recent stipends help temporarily, I'll be honest, but we need permanent raises that keep great teachers and school employees in our schools. That's something we've been fighting for at the Capitol every single year. And until we continue to really see an investment and what we say is at least a fair pay, we're going to still see people who make different decisions for their families, but also those things also impact our students. So support and resources are also some of the top on the list.
I think issues. Somehow the message gets confused in that it's not about people wanting to be teachers because they get paid. You don't necessarily want that. The idea is to attract the best and brightest that want to teach and have it be affordable for them to do that and feed a family. Accurate?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's really what it's about. And again, they're in possession and classrooms with students sometimes for 7, 8 hours. And they have a love for that position that they hold, and that's to care for our young people. And I looked at it when I was in the classroom as a noble position, one that, to me, I held in high esteem because I understood the charge that was given to me. I went into the profession myself not because of the pay. It was because of a love for want to help the next generation get the knowledge and information that they can become successful contributors to our society and to our communities.
I'm going to tell you what, I don't know if you want to get into this or not, but I don't think people realize the responsibility that teachers have and the pressure that they're under, both from internal forces with test scores, et cetera, and principals, but also from external sources with parents and expectations, et cetera. Do you want to get into that a little bit?
Yes. Look, there's a lot of pressure, I'll be honest, to not only help impart knowledge to students, but also deal with all the factors that go into that. That's having conversations with parents about a child's behavior, about a child's academic progress, and then having curriculum that's designed to help you get there. And if there's some issues with that curriculum, how do you go to an administrator and talk about, is this the right curriculum for that particular student or groups of students? It's a pressure that most who don't do that work really just don't understand, but it's a lot on your shoulders when you're carrying a load where you are the person in a classroom that's responsible. In most cases, I just talked to a teacher yesterday. She was, an elementary school teacher. She had 42 students in a classroom. She said it's very difficult to focus on instruction for 42 students, which when I was teaching, we were trying our very best to keep it under 26.
What grade was this, Larry?
This was fourth.
Fourth grade. So you're talking about 10-year-olds about or not?
10, 9, and 10-year-olds.
So you got 42 9- or 10-year-olds, and she's in the class. He's in the classroom by themselves?
She's in the classroom as the standalone, educator in that classroom, teaching that classroom. And she was just saying how difficult that is when you have all those different personalities and then learning styles, and not only that, but then how do you really make the lesson exciting enough to maintain an audience of 46 students, where that's unheard of in most cases, but what we've seen is,
did you say 46?
Because of the shortages, 46 students.
So yes, there you go. Let me take a break. When we come back, I'm just going to leave people with that thought. Imagine just babysitting, okay? Just babysitting 46 10-year-olds for, 7 hours?
Man, yes.
But it's beyond that, because you got to teach them And then they're going to get tested, and you're responsible for whether or not they got that material. 47 10-year-olds. Can you imagine just babysitting them for that amount of time, let alone trying to teach them? 651, 9 till 9, traffic, WWL. 657, 3 till 7, Tommy Tucker, WWL. I should say, if you're looking for Mike Strain, who is normally on at this time, no disrespect to our guest, of course, but he's in Ireland, so you'd have to get on a plane to go see Mike in the old sod if you want to see him, but he'll be back next week. Larry Carter, President of Louisiana Federation of Teachers, our guest, talking about, you know, before we went to break, 48 kids, 10-year-olds in fourth grade, one teacher. Good luck babysitting them for 7 hours, let alone teaching them. And it does come down to, Larry, and I don't think a lot of people realize this when it comes to teaching, that you got to maintain, you have a lot of responsibility without necessarily the authority that you need. And there is no worse combination, I don't care if it's business, if it's teaching, I don't care what it is, than having responsibility without authority, because they hold you responsible for things that are beyond your control. And in a classroom today, if you look at a kid sideways, and I'm not suggesting that teachers put their hands on students or anything like that, but teachers are under a lot of pressure from parents who don't want to believe that their child can misbehave, or different rules. You do the wrong thing, you might find yourself going to jail. Am I making too much of this or not?
No, you're spot on, Tom. In fact, one of the things I had been hearing too out on, you know, the trail, so to speak, and visiting all of these different school parishes around the state, is teachers identify for us that they're seeing more behavioral issues and student mental health needs than ever before. I'll be honest. And what I've often heard from them, they say, look, we need better tools, not just more rules, to help students succeed and keep classrooms safe, because that is somewhat what impedes great teaching and learning in those classrooms. And so we're advocating to make sure at the Capitol, at the BSEE board, as well as in schools when we meet at the local level with school districts and with superintendents, and talk about those issues, because it is an impediment to great teaching and learning. It really is. And we want to make sure that those young people get the supports that they need to be successful and to thrive. And so that is spot on. I'll be totally honest with you. I heard that quite often in my visits around the state this opening of school.
Somebody said, texted in, said, first time you said 42 kids and 46. I said 47, now 48. I don't know. If it's over 40, whatever it is,
it
over
46.
40. Over 40 is all 46. That matters. If you want to dwell on that little detail, if we misspoke, whoever texted this in. Larry, real quick, 20 seconds, a final message for parents heading into the school year.
Yes, I would say, you know, get involved when there's parent-teacher engagement. Attend those parent-teacher conferences. It's important for you to hear from your teacher and for your teacher to hear from you about your child's development, growth, and their safety. So I would leave you with that. Let's make sure that we get off to a good start.
Thank you, sir. 7:14 now. I don't know much about septic tanks or sewage systems, because everywhere I've always lived, it's gone directly into the city drain or whatever you call it thing. I don't know much about it. But Larry, Jeff Corbin, rather, the St. Tammany Parish Council member, joins us now to talk about the problem they're having in St. Tammany Parish. How you doing, Jeff?
Good morning, Tommy. It's a pleasure to be here today.
Thanks for taking the time. For people that don't know, because, and I'm not being silly about this, I think a lot of people that have never dealt with it don't quite understand how a septic tank works. And explain, if you will, before we get into what it is that you're looking to do, how a septic system works and how many people in St. Tammany Parish have that system.
Well, let's start with how many. In St. Tammany Parish, we have over 36,000 individual septic treatment systems. And some of those are just old septic tank systems, the typical ones that were used years ago, as well as aerobic treatment units, which have pump air and stimulate the effluent in order to go treat that sewage before it gets out into a ditch. Unfortunately, as we transition from a rural parish to a more suburban parish, a lot of these old systems were put in place. In fact, in my home, I actually have a individual treatment system I have on my property that empties into the ditch. And I first learned about this issue and how significant it was after I had been elected to office, but had not yet been installed into office, and set through a presentation by Tim Brown and Riker Toledano, one of the former council members, and they explain what's going on and how we're getting untreated and undertreated sewage is being put into our ditches, and then it's making its way down into our waterways in St. Tammany Parish and ultimately into Lake Pontchartrain.
And I don't want to gross anybody out here because it's 7:15 in the morning, but Jeff, when it comes to your property, and again, all I know is from living in Algiers and Belchays, where it goes into the sewage system or whatever, and they treat it, and lift stations and all that stuff. But when it comes to a septic tank and what's being discharged into the ditches, I mean, out into a ditch, a wide-open ditch, what are you talking about that's being discharged here? Raw sewage or not?
Well, no, it's not raw sewage. The systems, if they're functioning appropriately, are discharging treated sewage. So it's not clear potable water. You don't want to go drink it, but it's not water that contains raw sewage being into the ditches. But what's unfortunate is that there was a pilot program to inspect 1,000 systems in St. Tammany Parish. My district participated in that. And for example, in my district, they inspected 127 systems. Out of those 127, 33 failed. So that was, about a fourth of them, almost 25%, but across the parish that participated, 21% of them failed. So 21% of the systems in our parish in this random test, this pilot program, those systems that were tested, 1,000 systems that were tested, 21.5% failed. So they were putting either raw or undertreated sewage into our ditches.
So,
and that's bad for a variety of reasons.
So that is raw sewage is what you're talking about then, in that case, for the ones that failed.
Not all the ones that failed. Some of them failed and they were actually not functioning at all. Some of them failed and they were partially functioning, so you're getting undertreated sewage put into the ditches. I mean, like in where you lived, that you get collected into a sewage system, you never see it. Mm-hmm. It's getting treated in a massive system, like a regional treatment system, before it's discharged into waterways. And so they're under a lot of requirements to have that discharge inspected and tested to make sure that a utility is not discharging raw or undertreated sewage. But in individual homes, that same test program is pretty hard to go track 36,000 different systems throughout the parish.
You are an engineer, are you not?
Yes, sir.
Tell me, if you will, be nice about it, because again, it's early in the morning, but for us city slickers, explain how a septic tank works, because I really don't understand it. Does everything, when you take a shower, does all of that go in the septic tank? Because it seems like it would get pretty full pretty quick.
Yes, it does. What happens is, in a treatment system, the effluent coming out of your home is all collected and goes down your drain from your washing machine, from your shower, from your sink, and from your toilets. Mm-hmm. And it all flows and gets collected into one line, and that goes into your treatment unit. When it gets in that treatment unit, it sits, and there's some baffles in that treatment unit. There's there's some baffles in there that allow the sludge or any of the particulate matter to fall to the bottom, and there's an aerator that pumps air into there so that it gradually degrades any of the solids that might be in there. Mm-hmm. And then what happens is there's a line off the top, and the line off the top is essentially your treated water that comes out of the top of that system and then flows into your drainage ditch. So the bad stuff falls to the bottom, aerobic bacteria attack it and degrade it and essentially eat it up, if you will. And that's why you get treated water coming out. Again, it's not potable water, you don't want to drink it, but it's water that's acceptable to discharge.
How big is a septic tank? I'm just curious, how many gallons does it hold?
I really don't know how many gallons it holds. I can think that I've seen mine when this inspection program came. I actually volunteered because I had mine inspected for the better part of 10 years. I hadn't really thought about it. And so I went out, they came out and inspected mine. Fortunately, mine was fully functional. But when I looked down in it, when they opened the tops up, I want to say it's probably 3 foot by 8 foot, 6 to 8 feet by probably 4 or 5 feet deep. So if you can kind of get the sense of what that volume is.
Right.
And there's a couple different chambers in there that the water flows from one chamber to the next chamber, and it's gradually getting processed as it moves along. And then again, the effluent comes out of the top. And
so how often do you have to have that serviced? Do you have to have it serviced or not?
Well, you do have to have it serviced. And the program that we're going to put in place in St. Tammany is going to allow people to get theirs inspected for free.
Well, let me talk about that when we come back. Jeff, you found a perfect stopping point for us. We got to look at traffic, and we'll talk about the system that you want to put into place, which is why you came on. But for a lot of us that don't understand how septic tanks work, I appreciate Septic Tank 101 since you are an engineer. 720 traffic now, WWL. 725, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Jeff Corbin, St. Tammany Parish Council member. And what we're about to talk about, an ordinance that he and his fellow council member Impostato are talking about, I don't know who could be against this other than those who have malfunctioning septic tank systems. And if that's the case, well, you don't have the right to pollute the waters, right? So go ahead and tell me about it, Jeff.
Yeah, Tommy, we have a current inspection program, and we inspect about 2,000 systems a year today. Unfortunately, the system is tied when there's a power transfer on the property. And so, like, a lot of rental properties are going to be inspected more frequently. Mm-hmm. As I was mentioning, my property, I hadn't had mine inspected in many years until I heard about this program. And during the pilot program, they came out and inspected mine. And so what this will allow us to go do is inspect every system in St. Tammany Parish. It's free. The Councilman Joe Impostato, who worked on this and is really helping lead the charge on this effort, was able to work with our mosquito abatement district to get a $500,000 contribution over a three-year period to pay the upfront fee. So there's no fee for the inspection. Once the inspection takes place, then people will be certified for 3 years for their system. Now, why 3 years? Well, some of the data indicates that every 3 years is a good cycle to go test. But for example, in my system, when it got inspected, I had inspected it for about 10 years. It was working fine. I didn't need any major changes to it. But that's not the way it is in all systems, because systems are demand-based. My wife and I raised 3 kids in our house, and so obviously raising 3 kids, there was a lot more demand on our system when they were here than they are now, and they haven't lived with us for almost 15 years. So obviously our system is operating at a very low demand compared to if we still had 3 or 4 or more kids living in our house and living with us. And so the fact that this is for free, the inspection is for free, will help improve our waterways. We'll get the systems upgraded, identify what the problems are. Typically, they need to be pumped out, or an aerator's not working, or there's a structural issue. And we've also got a grant program to complement this for people that can't afford. Let's say, for example, you had an inspection, you find you got a structural issue, some kind of tank failure, and you need a complete replacement. We have a grant program to go help people go pay the cost of getting their system replaced. So this is not punitive. It's not trying to go identify people that have failed and then go hold them accountable and impose fines on them. The purpose of this is to inspect the systems we have in our parish, make sure that our waterways are clean and clear. And one of the additional benefits, besides not having smelly water in the ditch when you walk through your neighborhood, is a ditch that's contaminated with fecal matter of any kind is a harbor of mosquitoes, which transmit West Nile. So there's a variety of benefits. The biggest one is obviously our waterways. Most of the waterways, the bayous and streams in St. Tammany, are impaired today at different levels. There's reports available that can list out every location on the waterways that are impaired. And by going and addressing this at the source, we will not have sewage, treated or untreated, making its way into our waterways, which will help the environment in the area we live. People move in St. Tammany because they love the trees and the outdoors and the rural environment, kind of the rural suburban mix. But we need to get our waterways cleaned up, and you got to go start at the source to go make that happen.
Jeff, I admire you, but I don't envy you, because I don't think I could have a job where I had to actually seriously convince people why it was bad to put raw sewage in the water, in the public waterways. I don't think I could do that. But real quick, I was just thinking, as St. Tammany Parish continues to grow, is there any way any kind of subsurface drainage, like in other municipalities, could ever be put in? That would have to be prohibitively expensive, as big as the parish is, right?
Well, it would be expensive. I know there were some plans before Katrina to go make some efforts in that direction, and then Katrina hit and kind of all bets were off. In fact, my neighborhood was on a planned program to go implement subsurface. But there is a grant program that's being used to go put subsurface in one area, and we'd like to gradually over the long term get all these systems transitioned. Most systems transition where you're in a suburban kind of environment, you got a reasonable density of homes, to go transition those to regional systems.
Because not only do you have the infrastructure, but you have lift stations and you got sewage treatment plants, right?
That's exactly right. So you'd want to have those regional systems. We have neighborhood systems now. New subdivisions of any consequence are not being built without treatment of being available to mm-hmm. them. But this gives us an opportunity to first start addressing what we have, and then over a longer term, we need have a longer and broader plan, as you mentioned, to gradually go get all of our systems, or at least most of them, onto subsurface utility-like sewage treatment.
Thank you, Jeff. Appreciate your time. Jeff Corbin, St. Tammany Parish Council Member. Again, if I have to explain to you why it's not good to put raw sewage in open water, I don't know what to tell you. We'll talk to Steve Geller with his WWL Sports Director about the Saints. We come back right now. Time for WWL First News. All right, 744, 16 till 8. Drew Brees is going to be a special guest today from 5:30 to 6 on Sports Talk. They'll get Drew's take on Saints football, quarterback battle, head coach Kellen Moore, and the team's new strategy, plus, of course, NOLA Pickle Fest, which is Drew's annual pickleball tournament. Steve Geller, our sports director, joins us now, who, as we said earlier, is going to be at the Treasure Chest this evening from 4 till 7. How you doing, Steve?
Doing great, Tommy. Like you mentioned, Treasure Chest back there this year with Mike Dettillier, and having a great show to start things out. You mentioned Drew Brees, Deuce McAllister, Tulane football coach John Summerall joining us. Also, Tim Brando, Fox Sports commentator. So, hell of a lineup for the week one, well, day one start at Treasure Chest. And we got preseason games starting this evening. Mm-hmm. So, the next 4 days, we've got football action. Hallelujah.
Just be careful with Mike. I asked him for a piece of gum. Come to find out it wasn't juicy fruit. Anyway, let's talk about the quarterback situation, because here's my thing.
Yeah.
I don't know how you go about determining a starter, because I was talking to Deuce about this the other day, because you want to give the guy a chance with the number ones, but then a lot of playing quarterback is about what kind of looks you're seeing, and you're not going to see a lot of different looks when it comes to preseason from the opposing defense. So, man, how hard is it going to be for Kellen Moore to pick a starter here?
No, you're right there. You know, preseason offenses and defenses are going to be very vanilla. Hopefully, though, you're going to be running the basics out there, and we'll see how that interaction is between. I think it's safe to say Spencer Rattler or Tyler Shuck is going to be your starter. Jake Haener definitely seems more as a backup kind of role. He's been good at camp, but if you just take note of all the reps he's been getting, he's mostly been getting third team or second team reps, not really rolling with the ones as much. So Spencer definitely has the edge to me, which has looked better at training camp so far. We'll see what happens now in game action. But as you mentioned, that fact of, you know, you're not going to see, you know, all these different, this offensive genius mind that we hear of Coach Kellen Moore is not going to be on display against the Chargers. And I'm curious to see how much of the starting offensive line gets run in this game as well. I don't know if Eric McCoy, your starting center, is going to play, but I would imagine probably the other guys, because, you know, you're adjusting to a rookie on the offensive line and Banks, Trevor Penning switching to guard, and, you know, Fuaga is moving back to right tackle after playing left tackle last year. So that's curious to me, and the running back. There's a lot of questions with this squad. For sure, but just want to see a cohesive unit out there. Who's got the best command of this offense? And definitely not turning the football over is going to be key as well for the QB competition.
Yeah, because you think you know who your guy is, but then when the other defense starts throwing all of these looks at him, maybe you don't have your guy. Maybe what made sense in preseason doesn't make sense during the regular season, right?
No, and what we've seen at training camp so far, this Saints defense, I hope, looks good against the Chargers, because they have been causing a ton of pressure and problems for whoever's at quarterback. You know, you see a guy scrambling around a lot, being forced to throw off their marks, and that's something that last year with the defensive unit, at least, that the run stopping was a huge question, and has been able to quell the black and gold run game so far. So interested to see how things translate. Is it just that the defense has been, you know, this big turnaround with Brandon Staley, now the defensive coordinator, or are we in big trouble on offense this year? We shall see.
When it comes to stopping a run, how likely are we to see Devon Godshaw in preseason?
I think you'll see a little bit, definitely, maybe one or two series. He's a proven guy that's been around in the NFL. That, to me, Tommy, has been one of the biggest additions for this Saints team, and he's a big dude, too. Mm-hmm. So that presence in the middle as this big space eater was something that was not prevalent last year. You know, between Colin Saunders and Shepard, the run defense up the gut was just so weak. And, you know, you averaged giving up, I think it was 4.9 yards a carry, second worst in the NFL. You're not going to cut it. You're killing your team that way. So shoring up that run defense definitely was one of the prime focuses for me going into this year. And the Chargers have a heck of a running back stable, so we'll see how they stand up against that. But they've been doing their job against Alvin Kamara and co, so we're hopeful going into this matchup.
Yeah, you're not the first guy to talk about how big Devon Godshaw is, and you're not a small man. You're a big guy, and that's it's a locker room full of giants, but yet, even among that locker room full of giants, he stands out?
Oh, for sure. Just a massive, not just tall, but also wide, you know, a wide body.
Yeah.
And the players, a lot of them have just talked about this guy's strength and how, you know, much he's able to move the person in front of him. I think it was one of the, like I said, one of the most key additions that this Saints squad got this year, considering how lacking they were in that department we saw last season.
6'3", 311, and he ain't fat.
Right. That's some prime beef right there, you could say.
That's the best way to put it, I think. 6'3", 311, and there's not a lot of fat on him, so that's a big man. 7:50, we'll pick it up here. We come back 10 till 8, talking to Steve Geller, sports director. There'll be a treasure chest tonight starting at 4 o'clock. Right now, traffic, WWL. 7:56, 4 till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to sports director Steve Geller about the Saints taking on the Chargers Sunday. Of course, we got all the action for you here. Pre-game coverage starts at 11 o'clock. I was just looking at some video of Devon Godshaw trying a field goal and not doing too well in minute. But let me tell you something, and I know Buddy D is in heaven calling me a squirrel right now, but having done it, kicking the football straight on is not that hard to do, and these are extremely talented athletes. So I often thought it would be best to just get one of these extremely talented athletes in case the kicker gets hurt, because you never know. And just let him, you know, be able to kick a 35-yard field goal. It wouldn't be that, because these are athletes. You understand what I'm saying, Steve? These guys have superb hand-eye coordination.
Man, like you mentioned, he's done it before, and the fact that you never know. So, you know, yeah. God forbid, you know, we don't want to see anything happen to Groupie, but just in case, who knows, you might see Godshaw coming in for an extra point.
And even the straight-on thing, as opposed to the soccer style, I know that sounds old school, but it is not that difficult. And I always thought, just in case, why don't you have a backup, just in case? What can it hurt? Let's talk about backfield, Saints defensive backfield. What have you been seeing?
Yeah, the secondary is going to be interesting to watch. The cornerback group, Alante Taylor, we know is the alpha dog of this group now. No more Marshawn Lattimore, mm-hmm. Paulson Adebo in the group. And he seems to be, I would say, adjusting to Brandon Staley's scheme. He wants to be in that star role.
Why the hesitation?
Because the one thing that I would say has been a negative for Alante, we've seen two or three balls hit his hands and they've been dropped. And those interceptions are so key, just because you can sway the game and the momentum of things. And we know the Saints are considered, you know, one of the lower teams in the NFL, and those kind of plays could help sway a game and give you a victory. Alante just want to see more sure hands. The drops that have been sure interceptions are a concern right now. Other than that, I think he's played great. You look at the safety group, which I didn't think was going to be such a strength going into this year, especially when you see Tyrann Mathieu retires and you're like, uh-oh. Mm-hmm. But with Justin Reed, who was signed in free agency, and this addition of Julian Blackman, those two kind of remind me of old school Alvin Kamara and Mark Ingram as far as how they're gelling with one another. Very playful, a lot of fun, and hoping that translates onto the field. That's a group that has experience in the NFL, and like I said, I thought safety was a concern, and I'm not so worried about that now going into the year. I do think the corner group, though, there's some questions behind Alante Taylor. Kool-Aid McKinstry has been wonderful We'll see what he ends up doing in the preseason, if he can carry his hot start. He's been a guy that has been picking the ball off. And then the rookie in Quincy Riley, can he be that third guy, or does this team kind of need to scour the waiver wire once other teams release players to add another corner? I do think they still need another veteran body back there.
So going in, the starting corners would be Kool-Aid and Alante Taylor?
Yeah, right now that's a question, because Alante is your slot guy. So on the outside, it's feeling like Kool-Aid and Quincy.
Mm. When so much of that is, like you talk about Kellen Moore, Brandon Staley, a new defense, you don't want to get confused. You don't want to get confused. That's when trouble happens. Thank you, Steve. Appreciate it. Have a good time at Treasure Chest this afternoon.
Will do. Thanks, Tommy.
We'll be listening. Steve Geller, WWL Sports Director. We'll take a break. Come back. Talk to Alex Hammerstone, Director of Advisory Solutions for TrustedSec. Another day, another data breach. New app was hacked. And a lot of personal information was leaked. It's the T app, and we'll talk about it when we come back on WWL. 8:13 Thursday morning, August 7th. Tommy Tucker joined now by Alex Hammerstone, Director of Advisory Solutions for TrustedSec. How you doing, Alex?
Doing really well here in Cleveland. How you been?
I'm okay. You know, I just realized today would have been my dad's 99th birthday and my parents' anniversary. I didn't realize that on August 7th. But anyway, let's talk about this T-App data breach. I don't think my parents meant on an app. That was way, 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 way back in the day. So tell me what the T-App was and then what happened, or is, I guess.
Sure, absolutely. So, you know, there's a number of kind of forums out there, whether they're on social media or other places, where people share information about other people. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of Facebook has a lot of these kind of, are we dating the same person, where people share, you know, photos and ask if anybody knows this person, or, you know, early on in the relationship or something like that. And the T-App really is something that kind of takes that but puts it in app form, and also allows other things like performing background checks on certain people, or you know, having other conversations. So people are on there, you know, sharing a lot of information about other people.
So how do you go about, let me go back to the to the anatomy of an app. So somebody has an idea to say, you know what, let's create this application, this program that will allow women to go on and put information on about men they've dated and then rate them, or is that what was going on here or not?
To some degree, but it really was more about, I don't know if it was necessarily rating, like we kind of think of some of those sites and, you know, the old days that you rated.
Let me take that back. I don't mean rate as much as compare notes on people. Would that be better?
That's more correct, yes, absolutely. Okay. And really people to do research on other people. Mm-hmm. And again, these types of forms, really, they proliferated, but this was in an app form. And some people are familiar with the apps on your phone. It's a little bit different than a website. Mm-hmm. But think of it as a website that's kind of packaged and put on your device. Okay. I know that's a really simplistic explanation, but that's kind of how to think of it.
And to be clear, I was kidding around about my parents, but it's not a dating app. It was a dating safety app, right?
Correct. So it wouldn't be somewhere where you would go and meet somebody or a potential partner or anything like that. It was to discuss, you know, partners. Like, think of it like some of these sites or apps where people talk about an employer, right? Mm-hmm. So let's just say you're applying to go work at a certain grocery store, so you go on this forum, and other people will talk about the experience of working there, what the benefits are like, what challenges might be, what the bosses are like. Kind of like that, except for individuals, right? So, hey, I met this person. You know, we went on a date. It seemed kind of off. Does anybody know them? You know, have you been on a date with them? Can you give me information? Things like that.
So this was for women as it relates to men to compare notes to say, hey, what's the story on this guy? Accurate?
I would say that generally describes it pretty well.
Is there an equivalent is there an equivalent app for men for women or not that you know of?
There are. Okay. So really, there's an app for anything. It's almost impossible for there to not be an app about something. But, you know, certainly these things exist, you know, for all genders and, you know, things like that. I will tell you, I am very, very happy every single day for a lot of reasons that I'm married, and happily so, and not on the dating market, because it seems pretty wild these days.
Yeah, I got to tell you, it is wild. So these, I just want to do a little Internet 101 here. So the people that came up with this T-App, and it says it surged at the top of the free iOS App Store listings. They make their money how? this is not a nonprofit thing, right? How do the people that created this app, why did they do it?
So sometimes, you know, apps make money through advertising, right? Mm-hmm. You know, where they will serve ads, but others make money through subscriptions or selling certain services. And my understanding is that, you know, with this, there were kind of options where you could pay for kind of background check functions and some other things like that.
Okay.
So with any app, there are a lot of different ways to make money. You know, some more obvious than others, you know, some more direct than others. You know, on anything on your phone, you know, you download a free game app, it'll oftentimes, you know, have things that you can buy within the app or, you know, will serve videos. So if you're playing a game, you can get extra gems or coins or something for watching a video. So there really are multiple ways that they'll make money, you know, with any of these apps.
So what happened with the hacking of this?
So what it looks like is that, you know, some of the information in files were stored insecurely. You know, per the company, you know, these were files that were from users that had signed up you know, over a year ago and that they hadn't moved these files to kind of their new secure system. You know, and I haven't, you know, kind of seen that verified yet. But what's important to note is whenever you go and kind of share information somewhere, whether it's with a hospital or an application or what is it, what have you, it's that data is not necessarily stored by that organization, right? They use third-party services. They host it somewhere and so on and so forth. And so your data is really only as secure as the place where it's stored. And in this case, you know, concerning, I think, too, aside from just the personal nature of some of this information, is that it's information that was, you know, told to people that signed up that it would be deleted, right? Mm-hmm. And we've seen multiple cases over the years where data that should have been deleted was not and then was breached at a later date. And so it's just a really good kind of, refresher for people to think about where you're sharing your data. The other piece that really stands out with this one is, we've talked about it before, right? None of us want our credit card number stolen or our driver's license, but, you know, you can kind of recover from that. There are things that you can do. But if your personal messages, you know, things that are personal about you are disclosed, that's a much different thing. I always like to ask people, would you rather lose your credit card or your bank data, or would you rather have someone have access to every text message you've sent in the past 10 years? Everyone's going to say it's the first one, right? Because it's, you know, if you go to Thanksgiving dinner, no one's embarrassed that their credit card number was stolen. Mm-hmm. But they might be very embarrassed or upset by the contents of their messages.
Like the text that was sent at the table that, man, does this dressing suck, right? That one sibling sent to
like
the other,
that.
Talking about mom's dressing. Man, does this suck. Anyway,
right.
Let me take a break. We'll pick it up when we come back because I think the danger here, as I understand this, about this T-Data breach, and I don't know what 4chan is. I don't know if that's part of the dark web or not. I don't know. But it just seems as though that women that were on this app were put in a position where now maybe they said bad things about men and their identities have been revealed, as well as their maybe addresses in some cases, which could be potentially dangerous. We'll continue. We come back. Alex Hammerstone, Director of Advisory Solutions for Trusted Second. And a big question, too, when it comes to these apps is, you know, again, like Alex said, there's an app for everything. And you, for whatever reason, get all involved and you put your information in there. But you don't really know who's on the other side of it and who the custodian of that is. Are there any safeguards? 820 Traffic Now, WWL. All right, 825, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking about this T-App data breach where women use this app to compare men, or at least, what's the word? I guess that would be it, right? Evaluate, compare would be good. What do we say? What word do we agree on, Alex?
Probably share notes, right?
Share notes, okay, share notes. So what information did they have to put in? And that comes to what kind of information is out there? And then I talked about 4chan being the dark web, but I don't guess it is, right? I don't even know what the dark web is.
No, so a couple things. So generally when you signed up for this app, you know, you had to verify that you were in fact a woman, right? Mm-hmm. And so they did that through either taking a selfie or kind of sharing your driver's license.
Mm-hmm.
And so those selfies and some cases the driver's license, you know, were leaked and were out there. As far as what the dark web is, the short answer is it's basically just the internet, but you need a specific browser to access it, to access the different sites.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just a little bit different that way.
And where do you get that? From a guy in an alley or what?
Nope, you can go download it right now in their legitimate sources. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you think about it, there's a number of reasons, I think, why people, legitimate reasons why people use it and for privacy and things like that. But it's very accessible. You know, if anybody does a Google search, you could be browsing the dark web in about a minute.
So the danger of this T-app is it was breached. Men that could look and find things could be posted on 4chan, for example, about men or from T that were not complimentary about them, perhaps. And then they could then find out who posted it and the address of the person that posted it. Is that what I'm thinking here?
That's certainly one of the issues. So, you know, if your driver's license is out there, that's going to have your address on it, of course. People can kind of see what you may have posted or shared about, other people. And then any selfie, you know, people can usually identify you from that in multiple ways. So, you know, again, I think the biggest issue here is just to think about how much data is out there about us. And, you know, and it's not just, you know, these random apps or these kind of small new apps that have breaches. You see it with, you know, major companies, hotel chains. You see it with the government and so on and so forth.
Let me just jump in for a minute with the time we have left. So when it comes to an app, what kind of safeguards are there? If somebody's going to download an app like this and they ask for your information, who do you know is on the other end of this? And is there any safeguard in place to make sure that the person on the other end of the app is protecting the information that you're putting in as much as they can protect it? Because as you just mentioned, there have been God knows how many breaches already.
So the short answer is sort of, I guess. It's a tough thing to answer quickly. But it's when you think about kind of the regulatory environment, you know, if you sell an unsafe car, they have a recall, right? They bring it back, or there are certain things. But with apps, there really isn't that kind of standard. There's a number of kind of voluntary things out there. There's certain laws around privacy and all that. But all you have to do is really pick up a newspaper, or maybe that's an archaic saying, but just read the news, and you'll see that, you know, even these large name brand, you know, companies have breaches. And so we need to be doing a lot more, to prevent these.
Alex, what would you advise people when it comes to internet safety or address or driver's license number, something like that? I don't know. Tell me.
Well, the challenge is that a lot of places you have to share that information, right? You know, whether it's for healthcare or, you know, paying your taxes and things like that. But really, you know, limit what you share when you can, or at least understand the risk. It's just really challenging, for a consumer, because you don't know where your data is. And even if you trust the company with whom you're sharing it, they may have a bunch of other service providers that they're using to host these things. And so with all these different kind of layers and interactions, it's really tough. I think the advice I love to give to younger people is never write something down if you don't want to see that printed out and shown to you by your principal or by your HR department or even in court.
Tell me what you said again about bank data and text messages. I think that's some words to leave people with.
So just think about it, right? Think about your data and there's different kinds of data. And I like to say there's some data that can kind of ruin your day and some that can potentially ruin your life. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, no one wants to lose your credit card number. But, you know, imagine if somebody had access to, you know, things that you consider really personal, whether it's your text messages or photos or anything like that. And I think people just kind of forget, and oftentimes people are really too loose with what they share and how they protect it.
Thank you, Alex. Appreciate your time as always. Alex Hammerstone, Director of Advisory Solutions for Trusted Sec. We'll take a break, come back, talk about vaccines and what's going on with developing them when we return. Right now, time for WWL First News. All right, 8:45, quarter till 9, Tommy Tucker, WWL, joined by Mark Elaine Derry, a highly respected infectious disease specialist with extensive experience in public health and epidemiology. His expertise includes infectious diseases, emerging health threats, and preventative health measures. And I'd pretty well bet my salary that it's Dr. Derry, is it?
Yes, it is. Yeah, I'm an infectious disease doctor as well.
I figured it was. Let's begin by explaining what mRNA vaccines are.
Yeah, so mRNA technology or mRNA vaccine technology has been something that has been around since the 1990s. That's when it first started to kind of become a scientific principle. And we really saw it accelerated during the COVID epidemic. It had already been working. They had already been working on coronaviruses because that was the easiest virus to be able to utilize. So some things happened that were just completely coincidental. They had the technology, and the technology had already, they already started working on coronaviruses 5 years before the outbreak. Mm-hmm. So when the outbreak happened, coincidentally with the same virus they'd been working on, all the pieces were in place. And the whole, and the magic and the beauty behind mRNA vaccines is that the vaccine consists of, regular non-mRNA vaccines consist of parts of a virus or parts of a bacteria. We refer to those as antigens, and that gets injected into your body, and your body sets up an immune response to those antigens. That's how vaccines work that are not mRNA-based. mRNA-based vaccines don't inject antigens. What we inject are these small pieces of mRNA, which are genes, which we all of us have mRNA, message RNA. And what that does is that mRNA codes for a message, that's the M, to tell the immune system to make antibodies for whatever it is that's being coded for that vaccine.
A lot of us remember from biology RNA and DNA. That's about all we remember is RNA and DNA. We don't remember exactly what all of that means. And the reason I say that, doctor, is some people, you know, they get themselves all worked up over what they don't really understand. What are some misconceptions when it comes to mRNA technology and vaccines that you'd like to address?
Misperceptions? Sure. I mean, let me just also just kind of answer the first question, which sure. is DNA and RNA. Organisms, every organism on Earth is either a DNA. Most are DNA organisms, but some are RNA organisms, and that's viruses mostly. So DNA is what codes our genes. It's where our genes live. It's the DNA is basically the blueprint of humans or blade of grass or kitten or whatever it is, whatever life force there is. It is mostly run by DNA, but some organisms are RNA. And so the reason why the viruses are RNA viruses is that there's a lot of errors encoded in RNA, which works great for the viruses because they're constantly changing. So, and that's an evolutionary advantage for them. One of the things that my standard talking point when it comes to vaccines is this. Vaccines are like seatbelts. A seatbelt isn't going to prevent you from getting into a car accident. A vaccine isn't going to prevent you from getting the illness. A seatbelt mitigates the amount of damage that's done. It lessens that damage. If you're wearing a seatbelt in a car accident, everybody knows that you're less likely to push forward and hit the windshield or, you know, whatever. It just lessens the damage that a car accident can occur. Vaccines do the same thing. mRNA vaccines, particularly, we know mRNA vaccines saved millions and millions of lives around the world. And so all it does is it doesn't prevent you from getting the virus, in this case, the virus. What it does is it mitigates the amount of damage the virus could potentially do. And I think that's the most important thing that people need to recognize.
I think that's the best explanation I've heard in a long time. And as you say that, somebody texted in and said, I got the COVID shot, but I still got COVID. It was supposed to prevent the disease. And that's exactly what you just said is not the case.
Go ahead. Yeah, Tommy, let me address that really quickly. Mm-hmm. Let me address that really quickly. It's a very good point, and I want to address that. So the first vaccine against the first virus that we ended up referring to as the virus that emerged from Wuhan before it evolved into the Alpha virus, okay? Yes, it would have prevented that first. It prevented you getting that first virus that emerged out of Wuhan. But like I just said, COVID is an RNA virus. And like I just said, RNA viruses evolve very rapidly. That's their superpower. Like HIV, like influenza, that's why we have to get vaccines all the time. And like alpha virus or beta virus. So that vaccine was good just for the Wuhan strain, but it prevented you from getting the Wuhan strain, but didn't prevent you from getting the alpha, beta, delta, you know, epsilon, all the other viruses afterwards. What it did at that point was like a seatbelt. It just mitigated the damage.
Let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back. We'll specifically talk about RFK's defunding of mRNA vaccine research, which was touted as an accomplishment of the first Trump administration. I know last year we spoke to you about raw dairy. RFK talking about raw milk, 21 people sickened by it. He talked about the measles vaccine. He went to the funeral of two kids in Texas, then he backed himself up on that and said, no, get the measles vaccine. As we speak, somebody texted in and said, measles vaccines are 99% effective. This doctor doesn't know what he's talking about. Let me just say this. And doctor, you don't get involved in this. I'll handle this. Where in the world do you think, in what universe, that you know as much about this as our guest? I'd just like to know, really. In what universe do you think you know as much? And I'll read this man's credentials when we come back. 851, 9 till 9, traffic now, WWL. It is 8:57, 3 till 9. Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Dr. Mark Allen Derry, a highly respected infectious disease specialist, American Osteopathic Board certified in internal medicine, American Osteopathic Board certified in infectious disease. His qualifications are there, believe me. So when it comes to the announcement by, and we all knew RFK Jr. was going to do this, he's saying that the COVID-19 vaccines were unsafe and effective. It helped drive the evolution of the virus and couldn't keep up with the new mutations. And as a result, he says the mRNA technology poses more risk than benefits against those respiratory viruses. Now, when it comes to opinions, you can have your own opinion. But when you come to science, you can't have your own opinion about science. Doctor, address that, please, if you will. And what happens now from here?
Yeah, I mean, just real quickly, it's you know, I think Mark Twain once said that disinformation can circle the earth six times before the truth can get up out of bed and put their pants on. Mm-hmm. So this is a long lasting battle, and we just have to fight it. And all we can do is just put the truth out there, and we just hope for the best. So that being said, I just want to bring your attention to some of the catastrophic failures that the administration is doing. Right now, the vaccine technology was working on three respiratory viruses. One was influenza, COVID-19, and the third one is the one that I want to focus on, which is avian bird flu. Mm-hmm. That's the H5N1 that has, around the globe, has a 50% mortality rate. Okay, let me just say that again. That's 50. Now, if there is a bird flu outbreak, I don't think that mortality is going to come down. There's been about 800 cases globally and 400 deaths. The majority of them have been of healthcare workers. So healthcare workers are particularly interested in this vaccine. So the what we've seen are two deaths, one here in southwestern Louisiana, by the way. And let me just say, if you see a dead bird, please do not pick it up with your bare hands. If you need to pick up that dead bird, please use gloves, and please contact the state or look up how to dispose of that bird appropriately. We do have bird flu in southern Louisiana. This virus has the potential of being something that could spread and also be quite deadly. And the fact now that our best weapon for that virus has been taken away from us is.
Thank you, Doc. All right, here we go. 9:09. I love this hour. We call it the fastest hour on radio. John Alzheimer, our guest credit expert, formerly of FICO and Equifax. And I learn something every time he's on. How you doing, John?
Hey, Tommy, thank you again for having me for the fastest hour on radio.
It is. And look, the text lines are open. Oakenheart Jeweler talking text line 504-260-1870. Don't text and drive. And I would also say don't wait till the last minute because your question's not going to get in, because inevitably people listen. As you, and you know what happens, John, every hour. And then they start texting in by 9:45. And at that time, we don't have time to answer the questions. Let me ask you, first of all, I guess the difference between a credit score, credit rating.
Well, a credit rating is something that is assigned to a company, meaning like something that Standard & Poor's or Moody's does. A credit score is something that's assigned to a consumer. So there, you bring up an interesting point. I do hear the terms used interchangeably all the time, where some person complains about their credit rating when they're
unless you're selling bonds, you don't have a credit rating, right?
That's right. Yeah. So if you look up companies like Standard & Poor's and Moody's, those are companies that issue credit ratings versus the credit reporting agencies like Equifax and Experian and TransUnion. They're the ones who maintain your credit reports, and credit reports are the basis for your credit scores. Two entirely different things that sound kind of similar.
Yeah, not to waste time, but if you sell bonds and you don't retire them, well, you're not going to have a very good credit rating, are you?
Well, first off, if you're in a ton of debt, then you're not going to have a good credit rating.
Yeah. But no, I'm just saying about if you're a company and you sell bonds and then you, or an organization and you sell bonds and you don't honor them, you're not going to have a good credit rating, are you?
Of course not.
Yeah, there you go. All right, let's talk about, that was an inside joke. The people out there get it. Let's talk about, how often, let me get to the questions here, first of all, and then I'll ask some of my questions. Somebody wants to know, is it true that if you pay your credit card twice a month on the balance, you will not get charged interest?
The only way you're not charged interest, it doesn't matter how many payments you make per month. You can make one payment, you can make 10 payments. If your balance is paid in full before the due date, then there's nothing to assign interest to. So it's I've got a great story on that one, Tommy. I have many credit cards, and I've had them for many decades, and I couldn't tell you what any of my interest rates are because I don't care, because I don't carry balances.
Right there with you.
So the only way you pay interest is if you carry a balance from 1 month to the next by not paying it in full by the due date. So you can pay it in full the day before the due date. You can pay it throughout the month, and then it ends up being zero by the due date, or twice as the caller or the texter suggests. It doesn't really matter. As long as the product of all of your payment is a zero balance by the due date, then you're not going to be assessed interest. And so that's where the interest rate, whether it's 20% or 30%, becomes entirely irrelevant.
I'm going to assume, and I shouldn't do this because you know what happens when you assume, but I'm going to bet that they're conflating what you said about an ethical hack before.
Yeah, and you can go on your credit card account on the app or on their credit card's website right now and make a payment. You can make a $100 payment or you can make a $1,000 payment. It doesn't matter. You can make whatever amount of payment you'd like. And as long as that balance is zero before the due date, no interest. As long as that balance is zero before the statement closing date, which is different than the due date, then you're going to have a zero balance on your credit report, even though you use the card throughout the month. And if you're able to do that, then not only, one, are you not going to pay any interest because there's no balance, but number two, you're going to have a zero balance show up on your credit report, which is obviously good for your credit scores.
This is an interesting question, and I guess it depends on card to card. Do the points ever outweigh the 4% that you pay if the retailer passes that along?
Points as in reward points?
Yeah. I guess it depends on the card,
so,
right?
Yeah, look, If you ever look at any of the surveys of why people use the cards that they choose to use, for those who are in a position to choose their card versus people who have horrible credit, who don't have a lot of options and are kind of stuck with some really bad subprime cards. But for those people who have decent enough credit where they can kind of choose from the inventory of credit cards that are available, you'd be surprised why people choose to use the cards they use. Number one, it's usually something wrapped around the rewards they get, which makes perfect sense why so many credit cards have some sort of a rewards program tied to it. Here's the downside to rewards programs is that they're not free. They're subsidized by the interest rate that people pay on their balances. Now, kind of back to the previous listener, as long as you pay it in full by the due date, then you're not paying for anybody's rewards program, so you're not subsidizing the cost of the program. But if you do choose to carry balances on rewards credit cards, you're kind of paying for your own rewards. And you're also helping to subsidize the rewards for other people who also have the same card. So, again, this is yet another. You can pile it on top of the 50 reasons why it's a good idea to pay your credit cards in full every month. And this is yet another one, is you're not subsidizing, number one, your own rewards. And number two, you're not subsidizing the rewards of other people who have the same card.
I think the question was directed toward, and maybe I'm misinterpreting it here, like, for example, I pay mine every month, and I love earning the points because you can take 67,000 points and turn that into $670 of payment toward the credit, right? Toward the credit card, whatever it is. That's, I don't know if there's a better way to use points or not, but that's the way.
Well,
I
have a cash back. Yeah, if you have a cashback card, and that's, you know, if you look at all the different types of rewards programs, you have airline miles, you have cashback, you have hotel points, you have rental car points, you have all these different options you can choose from, and some of them are complicated, right? Like X number of points equals Y number of dollars for some sort of a flight, or for a car rental, or for a certain type of hotel. One thing that we all understand very, very well is the value of cash. Mm-hmm. So if you're telling me that for every, you know, $100 I spend, I'm going to get $2 in, quote, cash back rewards, that's very easy for me to understand it, because mm-hmm. I know what the value of $2 is. I can either apply it to my balance, I can let it aggregate and then use it to buy a gift card sometime in the future. So if you're kind of stuck in the middle of rewards programs and you're not really sure which ones to choose, then I always tell people, look, default on the cashback option because we all understand the value of money. And then if you want to kind of do your research into the rewards points or the airline points, or excuse me, the hotel points or the airline points or the rent-a-car points, or just like the generic rewards points that can be used for almost anything, then that's fine. Delve into those areas. But if you're not interested in doing that type of research, pick yourself a good cashback card and then be done with it.
That's what I do. I just take it the easy way and then apply it toward the payment. Somebody wants to know, is there any downside to having a freeze on your credit at the big three? And I guess you should define what the big three are, and only unlocking it when you go to apply for something like a credit card.
Well, I mean, the question itself is the exact reason why you should have security freezes. So the big three, Tommy, are, of course, the big – people generally refer to Equifax, Experian, and TransUnion as the big three, or the big three credit bureaus or the national credit reporting agencies. We kind of use the synonym for – they're all the synonym of the same thing. A security freeze, which is free, by the way, if there's no cost involved with doing so, is essentially the consumer taking the credit report out of circulation at – one, two, or all three of the credit bureaus. You have to do them independently. So there's no one-stop shop to freeze all of your credit reports. You have to do them independently at all three bureaus. But when you do, you prevent any new lender from being able to access your credit report. So it doesn't stop the fraud from being attempted, but it absolutely stops fraud from occurring because lenders can't pull your credit reports or see your credit scores. So the question about should I freeze all three and then only unfreeze when I apply for something, that is the garden variety or the best practices use of the security freeze, is you freeze your credit report, because most people are not applying for credit all the time. They do it periodically when they actually, you know, have some sort of a life event, like they want to buy a house, they want to buy a car, they want to refinance something, they want a new credit card, they need to take out a student loan because everyone's about to go to college in the next week or so. So there's a life event where you have to get access, you want someone to have access to your credit reports, and you can go in and you can thaw them. It's, you know, kind of cute, freezing and thawing. You can thaw all three of your credit reports. You can usually set like a time frame, like thaw it for a week and then refreeze it, thaw it for 2 weeks, then refreeze it. Give the lender, whomever, access to the credit report to do what they need to do for underwriting. Then it refreezes, and then boom, you're safe again from any credit related fraudster.
So how do you do that? How do you freeze your credit with the big three?
Easy. It's so easy, Tommy. I can't believe more people don't do it. Here's a good way to find the websites. And so all three of the credit reporting agencies, well, first off, before I go there, you don't have to pay anybody to do this for you. This is entirely free. There's no cost involved in doing this. All three of the credit bureaus on their websites, their independent websites, give you the ability to freeze your credit reports. So if you Google something like, you know, TransUnion security freeze or Equifax security freeze or Experian security freeze, you're going to get the link directly to the security freeze component or portion of their website. And then you would go in and then you would sign up. You need to set up, obviously, a password, because you're going to have to go in and give the password to thaw the credit report whenever you want to do it. Don't lose those. Write them down somewhere. And then you freeze them, and then they're essentially – think of like an old-fashioned filing cabinet with a bunch of folders in it, Tommy. Mm-hmm. You're essentially taking your folder out of the system, which means no one can have access to it until you put it back in the system. The only exception, obviously, is if you have a pre-existing relationship with a lender, then that lender can continue to pull your credit report for the ongoing maintenance of your account. Or if a debt collector is trying to collect a debt, then they can have access to the report. But if some bozo tries to open a credit card in my name, good luck, because they're going to run into a wall because all three of my credit reports are frozen and out of the system. And so the lender isn't even going to be able to pull my credit. So it's going to stop the fraud in its tracks, which is the whole purpose of the security freeze.
I get ready. I'm going on a limb. You might have to catch me here, John. All right. So would freezing your credit with the big three also prevent a hard pull on your credit, which could affect your credit score?
Yes, that's what it prevents. It prevents the, so if you, let's say hypothetically that you do not have a relationship with Wells Fargo, mm-hmm. and your credit reports are frozen, and some fraudster goes to the Wells Fargo website and tries to apply for credit in your name, and Wells Fargo tries to pull your credit report, they're going to hit the wall, and the wall is the security freeze. So they're not even going to be able to get to your credit report to finish the hard inquiry. And by the way, you're going to be notified, hey, someone's trying to pull your credit, which kind of gives you some good peace of mind that the security freeze is actually working. So, there's varying levels of ways to protect your identity from credit fraud. There are more passive ways, like if you have credit monitoring services, they'll tell you after something has happened, like, hey, a hard inquiry has occurred. If it was fraudulent, do something about it, versus the security freeze, which prevents the hard inquiry from happening in the first place. So people are always like, well, wait a minute, then why doesn't everyone do that? Why isn't that like the de facto option for protecting your credit? And here's the reason. If you don't unfreeze or thaw your credit reports, meaning you forget to do so, and you're standing there, at a car dealership and you're trying to finance a car, and they're not going to be able to pull your credit. So some people look at it as an inconvenience, and so they choose not to freeze them because of that, which is fine. I get it. And everyone gets to make their own decisions. But if you are someone who has been the victim of fraud in the past, it's probably not a bad option to freeze all three of your credit reports, just to make sure that no fraud continues to occur.
Fraud aside, I know a hard pull can affect your credit score. Can a retailer pull that without your permission, express permission?
Not having anything to do with the whole security freeze topic that we were talking about, mm-hmm. No, it's not the wild, wild west. Organizations can't just pull your credit reports without what's called a permissible purpose. And a permissible purpose is a legal term found in the Fair Credit Reporting Act. There's a list of them. I think there's either 7 or 8 permissible purposes, which give the credit bureaus and lenders the legal right to access your credit report information or to provide your credit report information. Obviously, one of those is in response to an application for credit, application for insurance, if you're applying for a job, if someone's trying to collect a debt, legitimate business reason. There's a lot of like legitimate reasons why your credit report could be pulled, but just pulling it randomly without the consumer's either permission or knowledge, then obviously that is not something that's permissible.
Right, let me take a break. We'll come back. We'll pick it up with the questions from the listeners. Also, the difference between a hard pull and a soft pull, how it can affect your credit score. Fastest hour in radio, John Alzheimer, credit expert, formerly of FICO and Equifax. You can go to Equifax, Security Freeze, Experian Security Freeze, TransUnion Security Freeze, and from there it'll lead you to how to freeze your credit, and that's some free protection you can have. 924, back in a flash, WWL. All right, we're talking to John Alzheimer, our friend, credit expert, formerly of FICO and Equifax. It is the fastest hour in radio because the questions pour in and we get to as many as we can. John, difference between a hard pull and a soft pull, which can affect your credit score and why?
So a soft pull is generally done, number one, by the consumer who wants to see their own credit report, or for some other reason, generally not in response to a consumer overtly applying for credit. So if you have an existing relationship with a credit card issuer, they may pull your credit report from time to time to do account management. Or if a credit card issuer wants to prospect and send you a pre-approved offer, they may do what's called a soft pull. Hard pull, and a soft pull has absolutely no effect on a credit score. Credit scoring systems don't even see soft pulls, and lenders also do not see soft pulls. Only the consumer sees the soft pull. Hard pull, different story. Hard pull is seen by pretty much everybody. They can lower your credit score, but it's not a guarantee. It's one of the great myths of credit scoring is that inquiries always lower scores. That's factually incorrect. They might not. Generally, a hard inquiry or a hard pull is in response to somebody overtly applying for credit. Like you go out and you try to get a mortgage, you go out and you try to get a credit card, try to get an auto loan. And a hard pull, by the way, it's a requirement. It's a federal law requires the credit reporting agencies to maintain a list of inquiries so that consumers can see who it is that's pulling their credit report. So it's not like something that they're just choosing to do. Mm-hmm. They're required to do so. And they have to maintain a record of those inquiries for up to 2 years so that we can see who's pulling our credit reports.
All right. Somebody texts in and said, is it better to carry a... Oh, by the way, somebody texts in about a power outage in Kenner, and I checked, and there is one on Williams Boulevard. It would appear to be on both sides of the interstate and also on West Esplanade, so be aware of that in that area. They could have some streetlights out, et cetera. I just wanted to pass that along. Somebody texted in and wants to know about carrying a small balance every month as opposed to paying it off.
Yeah, that's one of the myths that you see a lot on the different kind of social media credit repair type of locations. Mm-hmm. Is, hey, if I carry a little bit of a balance, is that somehow better for my credit score or my, you know, credit management than if I paid in full every month? There's, you know, unlike most of the credit scoring myths, Tommy, there's a little bit of truth to this one. FICO has said publicly, so I'm not saying something that is a trade secret, that if you have 1% of your credit limit on your credit report as a balance, that's actually better than having 0%. And when I say better, I'm talking about minimally. So it's not like the difference between FICO 850 and FICO 650 here. Mm-hmm. I've always kind of laughed at that because, number one, good luck. You'd have to add up all the credit limits on all of your credit cards, figure out 1%, what 1% is of that, go out and make those purchases, and then pay your balance down so that it equals 1% when all of your credit cards cut their statement. So, yeah, good luck with that. It's a whole lot of work for not a whole lot of value. So what I always tell people is, look, if this is where you are in your credit score improvement strategy, then you're doing probably so well that just pay the darn thing off in full by the due date or before the statement closing date, and then, you know, move on to something more important that is more worthy of your time than trying to keep a 1% balance on your credit card.
So Equifax, Experian, and TransUnion give you a FICO score. That's a scoring system?
So it's a little bit complicated. Do you remember the old Intel Inside commercials from a decade or so ago where you'd buy a Dell computer but would have an Intel processor
inside?
Think of it like that. So FICO, which is a completely different company, which is a publicly traded company, their own, you know, freestanding separate company, traded on the New York Stock Exchange for many, many years. What they're primarily known for, although they do other things, they're primarily known for their work in credit scoring systems. They essentially invented the credit score, and since the very late 80s, their credit scoring systems have been kind of the gold standard in credit scores used in the U.S. and Canadian and many other markets throughout the world. And so what you need in order to calculate a score, Tommy, is you need two things. You need a credit scoring model, and then you need a credit report. Well, FICO isn't a credit bureau. They're not one of the big three. So they essentially have relationships with all three of the credit bureaus in the U.S. where the credit bureaus license the use of FICO's scoring models. And then the credit bureaus can then filter their credit report data through FICO's scoring models, which calculates a score, which is then connected to the credit report, which is then sent to your lender, who then uses all that information to help make a decision.
What scores matter? What scores don't? Because I get people texting in about, you know, 820, 850. You're just bragging at this point. What is the perfect score? And does anybody ever achieve perfect?
Yeah. So in most of FICO's scoring models, the range is 300 to 850. There are other scoring systems that have what are called longer ranges, so a wider range than that. But generally speaking, the published range that has been discussed for, what, three decades now is 300 to 850. Mm-hmm. And so 850 in that context would be a perfect score. There are a lot of people who will hit 850, and your credit score is is kind of like the temperature. It's always changing, right? It's never the same for some permanent or prefixed period of time. Your credit score can change whenever data on your credit report changes. So next month when some lender pulls your credit report, your score may be 7 points higher, 12 points lower. It depends on what the changes were on your credit report in the interim. But yeah, if you look at any of the FICO score distributions that FICO publishes periodically, about half the country has scores at or above like 720. Mm-hmm. So most people in this country have pretty good credit, and the number of people who have scores above 780, above 800 is actually very impressive. So do people hit 850? Of course they do, all the time. Do they stay at 850 for an extended period of time? No, because they may use their credit card more this month than they did last month. So their balances go up, but next month they may score may go back up. So, but you're right. Your kind of comment about at this point you're showing off. That's exactly right. Because as long as you've got 760, 780 or above, you're kind of showing off at that point, because there is no product that some lender out there is reserving for people who have FICO 850. Because that would be such a small percentage of people that would be essentially qualified for that product. And the story that the credit score tells at 780 is a very good story for not only you, the consumer, but the lender, which is you're essentially void of credit risk. And so, you know, the last time someone was declined because they had FICO 780, it may have been because they didn't have an income sufficient to justify a loan amount, but it certainly wasn't, it didn't have anything to do with their credit risk, because there essentially was none.
Let me take a break here, John. When we come back, I want to talk about, credit scores are fine, but it's not just a number, right? I mean, there's a reason behind it, and at what point does it break to an A, B, C, D, or an F when it comes to credit, and at what point do you strive to get out, or what, to get the better interest rates, and how do they determine that? Or what do they use those credit scores for, I guess? Fastest hour in radio, John Alzheimer, our guest, credit expert, formerly of FICO and Equifax, 504-260-1870. If you got any questions, no texting and driving. Somebody texted and said, I'm at 834. How can I get to 850? Well, you should have just heard what John said, which is, you're just bragging. 938, 22 till 10, traffic now, WWL. 9:44, 16 till 10. We're in a lightning round now. Dollar values are tripled. John Alzheimer, credit expert, formerly of FICO and Equifax. John, how long does it take to enact or retract a credit freeze?
Well, you can usually do it on an app on your phone or the credit bureau's websites. And so, what, like 30 seconds?
Okay.
It depends on how, if you know your login and password, you know the website, boom, you're done.
And it happens immediately, and it's
correct.
Retracted.
Instantaneous.
Okay.
That's right. Instantaneous.
Will freezing one be good enough?
Nope. That's like, let me add on a little bit to the lightning round of the previous question.
Okay.
Don't wait till you're sitting in front of the banker to thaw your credit report. Do it like the night before.
Okay.
I mean, you can test the system if you want. I've actually found myself in that pickle once before. I was sitting in front of at a bank trying to open a checking account, and they're like, well, we can't pull your credit report because it's frozen. I'm like, god darn it. And so I had to go out in the lobby and mess around with my phone, and I did it. And
did they know who they were talking to?
That didn't matter. I don't pull that card.
Should have called me. I'd have vouched for you.
That's right.
Somebody
talk
said
to Tommy.
Yeah, someone wants to know about freezing one, but that's like locking one door and leaving two unlocked, right?
Yeah. No, I don't like that option at all. Again, look, there's no cost involved. So there's no, you're not tripling the cost of anything by doing all three. Yes, you have to do it independently at all three, but I mean, I know all of your listeners are in Louisiana and I'm in Atlanta. And
well,
so,
no, we're in Mississippi. We're going to Mississippi.
Okay. So Mississippi also, but so if they apply for credit somewhere, Tommy, they don't know what credit bureau the lender is going to pull. They could pull Equifax. They could pull TransUnion. They could pull Experian. They don't know. So, and that's not publicized, and there's no geographic preference any longer. It used to be many years ago, but not any longer. So if you really want to protect yourself, I would suggest doing all three. Yes, does it triple the work you have to do when you're going to go apply for credit? Yes, of course it does. You have to thaw all three of your credit reports. It's not supposed to be easy. That's the whole purpose of the security freeze, is to make it hard for someone who's unauthorized to pull your credit report. So it gives you the ultimate control. But yes, you do. You should do all three if you really want to. If you're not going to do all three, then don't do any. because you just don't know which credit report some lender is going to pull if some fraudster applies for credit in your name.
I'm going to ask this question that came in. I don't know if there is a lightning round response, though, and that is, what's the best way to fix bad credit?
Yeah, there isn't. If there was, then I guess more people would have bad credit if it was easy to fix. Here's the simple stock answer. Good credit is the product of paying your bills on time, staying out of credit card debt, and applying for credit sparingly only when you need it. If you do all those things, then you're done. You don't really need to do anything else because you already have good credit. If you have bad credit because of some life event or, you just are not good with credit, then you're going to have to start paying your bills on time, staying out of credit card debt, and applying for credit sparingly. And then as the years go by and as all this bad stuff falls off your credit report because it's essentially timed out, then your credit scores are going to improve, your credit reports are going to improve, and if you'll just kind of lather, rinse, repeat, and continue to do all the right things, then you're going to live a more prosperous and cheaper lifestyle because you're going to pay lower interest rates on pretty much everything. The cost of credit is going to go down for you.
Somebody wants to know how they can check their credit score. I don't know. We've addressed that.
Oh, how to check your credit score?
Yeah.
Well, there are a lot of ways. First off, you're not going to need your wallet because this is every option that I'm going to give you is free. So you shouldn't. You don't need to buy your credit score any longer. It's not a product per se. Experian gives away free FICO scores on their website. There are any number of websites that will give away free VantageScore credit scores, so Credit Karma, Credit Sesame. If you have a credit card with any number of credit card issuers, Amex, Discover, Chase, Wells, then they give away, Cap One, then they give away free FICO or VantageScore credit scores in the app. So all you have to do is go into your app and you can check your credit score and again, this is all free because you already have relationships and do business with these companies. So you don't need to go out and spend a bunch of money to buy credit scores any longer because of the free options.
This is a great question that popped up that I never, ever thought about. Does settling debt with the IRS affect your credit rating?
No, it doesn't. It used to. So tax liens used to be on credit reports, but they are not any longer, and they haven't been since 2018. So for 7 years now, tax liens have no, and also the same with civil judgments.
Mm-hmm.
So tax liens and civil judgments that routinely were on credit reports are no longer on credit reports. And so if you have a tax lien, then it's still a public record, and it's mm-hmm. not hard to find if you're a lender. And if you settle it, then it's just going to show up as a released tax lien. Again, it's still a public record that any lender can easily find, but they're not going to find it on a consumer credit report.
So really, the good news is the only thing you have to fear is federal prison, right?
Well, there's a lot of downside with not paying your taxes.
I was just kidding.
Yeah, you don't look. I always tell my accountant, look,
yeah.
I pay you for one thing and for one thing only.
Keep me out of jail.
I never ever want to get a phone call from anyone from the IRS.
No,
that's
I'm right there. John, I'm right there with you, buddy. It's like, you know what? I don't want anything questionable. I don't want this. I don't want that. I filed an extension. I got a big payday coming up. But you know what? Just do what it takes because I don't want any trouble with the IRS at all. All right,
nope.
Seriously. So real quick, when somebody texted in and wants to know about bankruptcy and how serious of a decision is that and settling credit card debt and all that kind of stuff. You say if you go up belly up on credit card debt and settle, that is going to affect your credit report, right?
Of course. I mean, look, credit cards are, it's the difference between what's on the credit report and what's not on the credit report. All that tax lien stuff, not on credit report. All that credit card stuff is on credit report. So anything you do with respect to your credit card, it's fair game for credit scoring systems to include getting in a ton of debt, missing payments, defaulting, settling. All that stuff is on a credit report, and it's all considered in credit scoring systems. And you can assume that none of that stuff is good, meaning being in excessive debt, going late, defaulting, being charged off, settling. None of those things help your credit score. So, are they alternatives? Kind of talking to the settlement option versus the bankruptcy option. Are they ways to get out of credit card debt? Of course. There's pros and cons. There's financial pros and cons to both. People talk about bankruptcy as if it's like this, the worst thing you possibly can do. I'm not sure I agree with that. Mm-hmm. Look, it's an option. It's an option, just like you have a lot of other options with respect to dealing with your debt.
Real quick, John, I hate to interrupt, but we got to go and like 18 mm-hmm. texts pop up from different numbers about medical bills. Do they count on your credit report?
Credit score? So that's a hot one. That's been in the news a lot lately. So medical bills, it's a little bit of a misnomer. Medical collections can show up on a credit report. The CFPB and I'm not going to get all political on you, mm-hmm. the CFPB under the prior administration worked very, very hard to eliminate medical collections from credit reports. Under the new administration or the current administration, that looks like it's going to change, meaning that it looks like the rule that the credit bureaus would have to kind of mass delete all medical collections is not actually going to happen. And so, yes, there is a possibility that if you have a medical debt that goes into default, that is sent to a debt collector, can eventually show up on a credit report. There's a lot of ifs and buts to that, Tommy, but it certainly is a possibility. And obviously, if it shows up on a credit report, then, having a collection is never a good thing.
Thank you, John. Appreciate it as always. John Alzheimer, credit expert, formerly FICO Equifax. Quick break. We'll find out what Newell's got planned for us when we come back on WWL.